Welcome to the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast with your hosts, Matty Wood,
Matthew Davis,
and the Roto-Gut, Vlad Sedler.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast. I'm your host, Vlad Sedler. And this week, Matty Davis is out of town. He'll be back next week, but that's okay because we have an incredible guest with me tonight. He is one of the best fantasy baseball players in the universe, and I don't use the words best or universe lightly. This man, pound for pound, has the best resume across all the different formats of the NFBC. He's a former main event overall champion, taking down a cool six figures back in 2018. He beat out 2,800 other teams last season in the NFBC 50s Draft Champions format. He finished second overall in three different national competitions: the Primetime, the NFBC DC, the RotoWire Online Championships, those 12-team OCs. And that happened in 2018 when he won the main event and was within points of the elusive 75K bonus to win both those titles. He's coming third in the NFBC Auction Championship. League titles, main events, auction championships, 12 DCs he's won among leagues, 17 cut lines, all in total, 64 massive league titles over the years. And he is the eighth inductee to the NFBC Hall of Fame, who I'm personally ecstatic to be there to help induct, or well, I won't be doing the inducting, but to celebrate him in person in Vegas next month when he is inducted. He lives in Tinley Park, Illinois, with his wife. His two boys and two girls are all grown up and out of the house. And he's a grandpa of four as well. And he's a champ, a big numbers guy, and an incredibly humble man. And I'm very honored to welcome to the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast, Mr. John Posma. What's up, John?
Hey, Vlad. Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to talk some baseball and hopefully some baseball and not all about me, but yeah, we could talk a little bit as well. So thanks for having me on.
Of course. We'll kind of do a little bit of both. But first of all, I'm just curious, how did it feel when you got, I guess it was probably a phone call from Greg Ambrosius at the NFBC letting you know you'd be inducted? Okay.
Yep. Greg called me and said, hey, we're going to induct somebody this year and it's you. And I said, are you sure? You got the right number? But He went ahead and rattled off some of the stats that you did and took a look at the accomplishments and said it was time. So it was a great call to get.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I mean, I personally haven't had, I've kind of had the good luck of not running into you in many leagues over the years. We have been in leagues together. Most of them, you know, have ended up being online, but I'm always seeing you there near the top. Of the standings. I know, especially the online championships. I know you've had tremendous success there, obviously success across all formats. And so, wanted to, introduce you. I know there are many guys like yourself that are, you don't necessarily, not there sort of, flashing, the goods on Twitter and talking about things. And so, people that have met you in Vegas and, we've gone to dinner together, know you, which is great, but kind of wanted to give people a little bit of a little background of your life, of how you kind of fell into baseball, and just your process with stats and in season and everything like that. So, from the beginning, where are you from? Where did you grow up? And what was family life in the early days?
Right. Yeah, that's good. Good question. I grew up in Wisconsin, like you mentioned. So I grew up on a dairy farm, actually. So Waupun, Wisconsin is like halfway between Milwaukee and Green Bay near Fond du Lac area. So grew up on a farm, did the chores like all dairy farm kids have to do before school, after school. And as that relates to baseball, I wasn't able to really play baseball at the town. The city was like 15 miles away, but we just had so much work to do on the farm and, the timing of when baseball was for Little League and things like that. So I never really got to play baseball, but I always loved baseball. It was just one of those sports that I just fell in love with. And of course, one brother and three sisters. And then my mom and dad were, they would play baseball with us as well and hit fly balls and fungos. And we would eventually have a couple games with some neighborhood kids on the yard, and a little different than what you guys might think of or normal. Mm-hmm. You know, a home run was over the ring number one on the silo, you know, and if you hit it onto the barn roof, well, that's a home run as well. And nice. If you hit it too far, then it's in the cow pasture and you got to go, go chase it down. But those were kind of the fun things that I remember growing up as a kid as it relates to baseball. And then we forever had baseball on the radio. So, you know, being in Wisconsin, I grew up a Milwaukee Brewer fan. I finally remember, you know, Bob Uecker, the Brewers, some of those great Brewer teams. When I milked cows with my dad, it was always a fight on the radio. Mm-hmm. You picture this old radio that's sitting in the rafters, and I had to climb up on a bucket to change the station. But he would always have the polka station on because he's convinced that the cows gave more milk listening to polkas. But I would flip it to WTMJ Milwaukee and whenever there was a game on. And so I grew up listening to a lot of baseball. And then, you know, after, I don't know, 7 o'clock at night, 8 o'clock, and then you go to the house and have supper, and then I would listen to some more baseball. I can remember the later it got, the more stations I could pick up. So pretty soon I could hear, Minnesota game or a Detroit game. And, I kind of got to know some of the announcers. So I don't know, something about the radio waves at night, they go further back and you could pick up more stations. But I remember that. We didn't have TV till I was like in seventh grade, not like, we could afford a TV, I think, but it was just like one of those things that our family didn't think that was important. And, so it was radio, and boy, I could just picture those games in my head. Uh-huh. It's a cool way. And for that reason, I still finally, I could listen to baseball in the car, anytime, and I love it. So
that's pretty cool. And in those days was Bob Uecker the announcer?
Oh yeah, Bob Uecker was then, and he still is now. He's got a little amazing limited schedule, but oh man, yeah, he called a great game. I don't remember. Pat Hughes was one of his partners, and then he went over to the Cubs. But yeah, he's had a number of different partners, but Bob Uecker and all his stories, and he could paint a picture like almost mm-hmm. nobody else, I feel like. And it was Cecil Cooper and Robin Yount and Paul Molitor, some of those players back then. I think my favorite might be Jim Gantner, just a mm-hmm. local kid. He came out of Eden, Wisconsin. We always called it the Garden of Eden, but he was a local kid, just scrappy. I guess I appreciate that. Maybe not the most talented, but he's kind of a grinder, right? So scrappy, uh-huh. I like that. So, yeah, a lot of great memories on that.
Yeah, it's funny. I kind of come from the other perspective. I'm one of probably the few people in the world that knew Bob Uecker from Mr. Belvedere.
Oh, yeah.
Before knowing he was an announcer, because really? That show was out in the 80s and I was a kid. And right. It just so happened, what was it? It was I told the story before, but basically the guy that got the older gentleman at the time when I was a kid in the 80s who first got me into baseball and would take me to Dodger games and okay. played for UCLA back in the 40s. He actually somehow he invited me to a live taping of Mr. Belvedere. And I remember a signed poster from, the youngest son, Wesley or whatever. And then I was like, oh, Bob Uecker, man, he's just got such a great voice. And then a year later, I don't forget, it was maybe 9 or 10. I was like, oh my God, he's the announcer for the,
Right.
So that was, that was really cool.
Yeah. So that's, he's my favorite announcer for sure. And it's kind of cool that he still does it. And he's really a part of that team too. Like when, mm-hmm. The players all love him, and he's just kind of a folk hero there in Milwaukee. But
was there a team that you disliked, like strongly disliked as a kid growing up?
Well, I didn't like the Yankees, right? Big market mm-hmm. team. In Wisconsin, you kind of get conditioned to root for the small market teams and the underdogs, right? I've always been an underdog guy. So, I kind of like the small market teams, but I do remember the Yankees in the World Series and Reggie Jackson hitting those three home runs in a game. Mm-hmm. I can just remember where I was listening to that radio, and you know, I don't remember who the announcer was or what the game was, but it had to be in the 70s, I guess. So maybe I was 12 years old or something like that. But yeah, it was great. I have some good memories of that.
You have like the memory, or just something? For me, it was the 88 Kirk Gibson home run against the A's in game one of the World Series. Was there something similar for you? Like maybe the 82 World Series for the Brewers, or any specific like moment or home run, or just something in baseball that really sticks out?
Oh, that 82 season for sure. It was so great. Mm-hmm. I was in college, so it was I went to college in Chicago area. So then it was a common college for a lot of Wisconsin kids to go to. It was affiliated with our church and the Christian college. And there was a number of Wisconsin fans on our floor at the college. And we would just every day, you know, they'd win another one in a row. They started the season with like 14 wins in a row or something crazy. And, you know, the whole campus was going pretty crazy on our floor. So we would post back then you just tape the headlines on your door and, you know, you'd be bragging about the Brewers, and it was pretty cool. That was a fun season. So,
yeah. Oh, and I apologize at the beginning when I said and I didn't want to bring it as a bad memory, but just, you know, that they made the World Series. So just making sure that I was right. Clear. I know that they didn't win. So
No, that was the best year that I remember for sure. Yeah. And then we would go to a game or two as a family as well. I have some memories of that. And now even today, you know, my wife and I, and sometimes with others, we'll go to 5-6 games a year up to Milwaukee. You know, we'll go to way more games in Milwaukee than we'll go to Chicago. Just, I don't know. It's the Brewers. So, yeah.
Have you visited many ballparks? Have you been, I know not everybody. Some people love to do the, you know, I'm going to go to as many ballparks and see around the country. I mean, I myself haven't been to too many, but how about yourself?
Yeah, I have been to maybe 10 of them or so. It was one of my goals to get to them all sometime. You know, I don't have a specific plan of that, but if we'll go out of town, or if I'm away on a convention or something, or if I could hook in a baseball game, for sure, I'm trying to do that. And a couple summers ago, we went to San Francisco and saw the Brewers play the Giants at Candlestick, or whatever you guys call it over there. But that was a good time. That's the series that Cueto blew out his arm. But it's kind of fun to see all the different ballparks and the different histories with each one. So.
Yeah, it'd be interesting if like Vegas had a team that we could all go to. I know it was a big deal when the hockey team came to Las Vegas and people were going to games during NFBC weekend.
Right.
That something.
Yeah, that is cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So in your, I guess, after college and everything, you know, I mean, in the 80s, fantasy baseball was very, you know, it wasn't a big thing yet. Obviously, you know, there was no internet and it was really sort of just evolving. Obviously, in the late 70s, things got started, but obviously not very popular. Like, at what point in your life, I mean, was it in your 20s, in your 30s, when you came across fantasy baseball? How did that happen? What were some of the type of leagues that you played on played in early on?
Good question. So not till college. I really wasn't familiar with it in high school at all. When I went to college, and then there was a group of friends that were they invited me to play. It was just a home league. A couple of those maybe. And then we got one of them was a points league with a company called Sandbox. I don't know if you remember.
Oh, yeah.
Really? That's great. That was one of the originals. So then I do remember that I would be the stat guy, and I'd have to get the paper and do all the stats that way. And they always sold on Wednesdays. I think they came out with the weekly fantasy edition, or at the beginning of the year, there was a special fantasy edition. The USA Today did a special fantasy one. And I would check at the time. I would check, you know, there's White Hen Pantries back then, a little convenience store in the Chicago area. I would go to maybe 6 or 7 of them just to try to see if they had it yet, right? Because when they had it, they only had 2 or 3, and sometimes somebody beat me to them. But I'd be looking for that magazine when it came out, or that paper. And you just didn't have the internet access that you have today, right? With all the, it's kind of weird to think about, but everything was in the paper and the box scores, and you'd study the box scores and look at the lineups, and it's just so different now. But I do remember that. And then, that's how it started, I guess.
I mean, at least for me, that were the absolute best memories in the 90s, the newspaper, pulling it up, looking at the box scores, seeing those leaderboards, right? You know, the home runs and everything, or even doing some of your automatic calculations. And,
yeah,
you know, I would always do all that by hand. I feel like a lot of people listening have done something similar to that in some effect, especially those that were younger in the 80s and 90s. So I think that was something really fun.
Yeah, no, I do remember that finally. And then at some point I got invited to go to I got introduced to the NFBC somewhere along the line. Actually, it was fantasy football first. And I just went to hang one of my buddies, Jack Hahn, played football with one of the contests. And he invited me to come along just to check it out. And I thought, wow, this is crazy. And then we partnered on a couple leagues maybe over the years. I can't quite remember exactly on the football side. And then baseball, then we heard about NFBC baseball. So I think it was through football that we became familiar with baseball. And then pretty early on, we started on baseball. So,
by the way, did you ever play in the Diamond Challenge?
No.
Was,
three,
okay, you missed that, yeah.
Yeah, the CDM thing or whatever. Yeah.
So, yeah, that.
The only reason I know anything about that was one of my good friends, Doug Gruber, was a CDM guy, and I guess he was really super good at it. I didn't even know that, so here I am hanging around with him in Vegas, and we're running into people, and they all know Doug from the CDM. Like, you're Doug's dogs. Like, wow, I'm by somebody famous here. So yeah, he was a great CDM player, and I think he still does play CDM. I've never played CDM.
Yeah, that's kind of the start for a lot of us. In fact, that's where I made a lot of my good friends. But you know, in the late 90s, I was in college in the late 90s, but I think my senior year when I started playing that, and this is a little bit after the changes, basically to make your weekly lineup changes or to make your player purchases, where you would get at the time it was 12 a season. Now I believe it's 16, and it's a salary cap format, but before you would have to fax in those requests and then you would get the stats in the mail once a week. So that was a little before my time, but I mean, we had this message board, the BBS, which is basically where we met everybody. I mean, you know, Lindy Hinkleman played there, Steve DiPinca.
Really?
I mean,
wow.
Ken Magner. I mean, you name it. A lot of the main players or people that started in NFBC in the early days, that's kind of where they got their start. And I remember, I mean, that's where I met Scott Jenstedt, who's obviously one of my best friends.
Right.
And he was Oaktown on that message board and just always just kind of knew everything. I remember also around that time, that's when he got onto that, what was it, the Stump the Schwab game.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You know, so got to the finals.
Yeah, I kind of remember some of this stuff. Yeah. And then I've heard some stories from Doug, too. And he had a phone in a lineup change and he didn't get there in time. I don't know, some crazy story. He didn't have enough. I don't know. You'll have to ask him sometime, but it's a pretty cool story.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, those are the good old days. It's crazy to think about how long that's been. And you know, what's great is that NFBC and Diamond Challenge, I mean, Diamond Challenge is now a part of NFC and that whole thing. So, I ended up joining one of those leagues last season for the first time in a while. And I think I'm going to do it again this year. I mean, it's fantastic. It's it's basically it's the beginning of DFS basically, because you pretty much have your, you know, salary locked in on these players for the whole season. And then, you know, you're kind of looking for those values early in the season. And then, anyways, that's a really cool game.
I hear I see a little bit of chatter on the message board about the pricing being a little bit higher or different. So it looks like they adjusted it a little bit maybe, but it seems like it's a challenge to come up with a good team, and it's an interesting strategy. I don't know enough about it, and I'll pass, I think, let you guys battle that out.
So you started, NFBC started in 2004. What was your first year playing?
Yeah, I'm trying to think what year that was. I'd have to look back at Greg's list, but 2000.
Well, Greg's thing, 2008, I guess.
So I missed the first couple of years, right. Yep, so 2008. And I went to St. Louis a couple of years. They had it in Chicago, a number of years in Chicago, different venues. One was at Cubby Bear, quite the experience. You know, they played around. We only had a couple leagues in Chicago. I think one time it was at the Rosemont, and one time it was at Hawthorne Racetrack, the other racetrack. But at a racetrack, you know, so we at two or three different venues, and now the last several years it's been at the same place up in Willowbrook at a hotel, and that's worked out nice. But interesting times, different venues is kind of fun, and you don't really know what to expect when you get there. And a couple of them were fairly entertaining with, you know, different. I think the Cubby Bear is the one I remember the most. It was just, yeah, it was next to Wrigley Field, so that was kind of cool. You could see Wrigley from there, and we didn't know for sure where to park, but then we figured that out. And there was some big event going on, music was blaring, and we went up these narrow hallway of up some steps, and then we all jammed into a room, and the music was blaring downstairs. It wasn't the best setup, but it was definitely, you know, we lots of memories about it. And yeah, all of us that were there won't forget it. And it's kind of a cool thing. So
how was that first draft? Do you remember it well? Like, were you nervous at all? Were you fully prepped? How did you feel about that first team?
Yeah,
the first live draft.
The first live draft, it was way over my head, right? Like, there's a big learning curve on some of this stuff. Yeah, you know, and I wasn't even sure how to pronounce all the names. And, you know, when you're on the clock, it's a different feeling when you're on the clock live, right? And yeah, the time goes fast. And then at that time, I had stickers. So I was always the one that, all right, don't hope you don't find that player real quick. Give me a little bit more time, and, you know, because they had to find the player, put the sticker on, and then the clock started. Right. So that was kind of fun. But yeah, I was nervous about it. But.
Was Brady Tinker doing the draft back then? Was he a part of the NFPC family back then?
He was only, I only know him from, he never was in Chicago that I know of,
okay,
or the St. Louis. So I only know him when he did the Las Vegas ones, but, yeah, I'm not sure when he came about, but yeah, there's legendary Brady.
Absolutely.
He's quite the auctioneer, right?
Absolutely. The best in the biz, that's for sure.
Oh, he's got stories about everybody, and you laugh about him, and then you do another auction, and he's got the same story, and you laugh again because it's still funny, you know? Yeah, he's great, so yeah.
So you started, at this point, 14 years ago, NFBC, and now you're going into your induction ceremony. I mean, have you already kind of have some idea of what you're going to talk about in your acceptance speech?
Just not really.
Roll with it, and
I think it'll be a short speech. I mean, most people are there to draft, and I'll say a few words, and I don't think. It won't be too long for sure, but I'm very grateful for the honor, and I'll say thanks to a few people, and it means a lot, and I don't want to take it lightly. It definitely means a lot. I think most people there are there to draft their team, and it'll be nice to be honored for that, and it should be fun.
Cool. Well, I'm looking forward to it, and hopefully they get all this figured out.
I'll be glad if it happens, right?
Yeah. So, no, we got to stay optimistic. Absolutely.
It's going to happen, right? We got two, three more days of negotiations, and boom, they got it, right?
They got to get it done. They got to get it done. So I want to talk about some draft prep and your strategies and just general things, but just real quick. For the people listening, want to tell you guys that you need to get in if you haven't already. Going for the hard sell here, but ftnfantasy.com, $39.99 for all preseason, all in-season content. We're pumping out a lot of stuff right now. Honestly, just working around the clock even though these free agent signings haven't happened and we're not at that point yet where ADP is really shifting. We're putting in a lot of work, just had our projections come out with over 600 players, nice and sortable. So, pitchers or closers depth chart that's really interactive that our guy Matt Cofferly did. Anyways, $39.99 for the season if you haven't already. Sorry to interrupt that with a little promo.
Hey, your draft guide is great. I've read almost all the articles in the draft guide. And you have a couple of writers that were new to writing, right? And they did great. Jenny Butler, super. Now she's on all kinds of podcasts and stuff. It's great to see her. And it was a really good roster construction type article, as well as, I'm enjoying the closer thing that Matt put together too. Very, very nice. So, Yeah, really, a lot of content there. I didn't check your cut line rating rankings yet, so I got to take a look at that.
But. Don't do it. Well, that's a topic I actually want to. We'll talk about that in a bit, and about how content is affects you. But just, I guess, let's talk real quick about the standard flow for you from by the time the World Series ends until March. I think we talked about it a little beforehand, but I would like for everyone to hear about it because our styles are kind of similar. And I think a lot of people that have been playing NFBC are sort of in the same boat, how you're progressing from, kind of get that break and then kind of moving from game to from contest to contest that is actually almost kind of specific to the month of the preseason in terms of draft prep and the type of format that it is. But just talk about your flow from when the World Series ends until we get to the main events in March.
Yeah. So, after football, I usually take a break, a month, take a month off. And I do follow baseball in the off season as well, like from the World Series, and then after that, take a little break, do some football. When football ends, then we should get going. But, I don't know if it's just my mind needs a little break from mm-hmm. baseball, just a little reset. And I just think, just from early on, I've been kind of an analytical type of guy with how I think about things. Maybe even I know I told the story with Greg when I was a little kid, 10 years old or something. On the farm, you have cows that need to get bred and we don't have a bull. So you do artificial insemination. You got to pick out mm-hmm. the bull. So we got to pick out. So I had a bull book. There's going to be farm kids that hear this that know what a bull book is, but uh-huh. it's basically a roster of bulls with all these characteristics, and you got to take the characteristics and match it up to the weakness of the cow, and boom, the next generation of cattle will be better than the first generation. So mm-hmm. it wasn't 10 categories roto, but it was something. And and then from there, just another example of thinking about math. And we would go on vacations, and I'm always thinking about numbers, always numbers. Mm-hmm. When we picked up rocks in the field, before we planted corn, how many rocks per hour are we throwing in the loader, and what's the total going to be? And when we're traveling to a faraway city or a vacation, we know it's 627 miles. Well, I could figure out how many hours that should be if we go mm-hmm. 62 miles per hour or whatever the case is. So I'm always thinking along numbers of rate stats, that kind of thing. So maybe that plays into fantasy baseball. And then when I start thinking about fantasy baseball, then I usually start when you get the forecaster in the mail, there's still something, even though we got all this electronic stuff. You get mm-hmm. You can get the electronic version of the baseball forecaster, but still, when you get that thing in the mail, that's like signifies the beginning for me. Something about that book, going through it, looking at it, you can see the same thing on your computer, but there's something not still the about that book. I don't know. I don't know if you feel that way too, but that print edition is still great to get. And one of the few things that are still in print editions probably, but I start just browsing through that, there's always some great forward comments, by different people, Chandler and the like. And then I probably around in January, I start with the DCs and then just to learn the player pool. I mean, the DCs are 50 rounds and 15 teams. And so that's 750 players. So, by the time the first couple of those, I don't know some of those players, so it forces me to look, either into the forecaster or RotoWire or what have you. Mm-hmm. But I do use a number of different sources to kind of look at things, including your FTN site and your draft guide. I try to read some of those previews. I think that's great prep. Another one I would like to just say that I've used over the last couple of years is the Chandler baseball stuff, Babs. And really was introduced to me more. I went to a couple of those first pitch forums that they sponsored. And, I wasn't crazy about them, but then the more I think back about it, I did learn some stuff from them. And I think the one thing I take away from those is just looking at a player it's helpful just to take the name off the name off the stats and then think about a player that way without the, without seeing the name, because you have so many preconceived ideas, right? And then you just look at the age and dollars earned and the several years in a row and have an idea which direction that player is heading, right? So I think that is so helpful. If you earn $15 and the next year you earn $17, and the next year you earn $19, and he's still 29 years old, you know, that, that player is on the rise, right? And then there's other ones. So just pointing up and pointing down, I think, is just which way is this player heading is a valuable exercise to do.
I was going to say, I think that is, it is really important because we all have our biases. It doesn't matter who we are, how good of a fantasy player we are. We have that things that are just built in. I mean, it's not to the extreme of, you know, just kind of rookie players or inexperienced people who are like, oh, he burned me. You know, somebody tweeted at me when I posted this random Dodger lineup that had Freddie Freeman in it as you know, just for fun. And somebody's like, oh, Mookie Betts sucks.
Nice.
23 homers and 10 stolen bases last year. And, you know, some, I don't always get into it, but I'm like, well, you know, he was playing hurt half the season last year with a hip, and he's still, you know, around 30 years old, or, you know, he's young. I mean, like, people have these biases built in, or, you know, against Stanton for so many years, or, you know, pitcher, just things that have happened to them. And it is so important, you know, like Babs does, and just the way that I think HQ has taught us over the years, and many other places as well, to be able to kind of separate yourself from that. I think fandom has something to do that with that as well. You know, I think sometimes we're even harder on our own teams. Like, we know our own team so well.
Yeah.
Our tendency is to maybe like, okay, I trust him more. Like, you know, for a while I was, didn't like Jock Peterson just for whatever reason. And it just, there's always these biases, and you're right. Like, being able to spot those trends, where players are going. It's important for me, for example, when I'm doing projections, because there are just so many factors involved here. But yeah,
right.
I mean, how about yourself? I mean, how do you handle your specific biases? How do you keep it from affecting?
It's impossible not to have some bias, right? So I just try to, I like to take a broader view. I know you guys are in the business of doing projections, and that's great. I don't know what all goes into those. You know, I look at yours, I look at RotoWire's, I look at a few different ones, and then, and I do, and I know they're all based, I just kind of like to take the approach of, hey, these players demonstrate this skill, and it's impossible to guess that somebody's going to do exactly, you know, 103 RBIs or what have you. We know he's a power guy. We know he's hitting in the right part of the lineup. So I kind of focus more on the other stuff, right? You guys nailed the skill stuff. I'm not smart enough to know which stuff is sticky in terms of all this, you know, batted ball data and, you know, the pitches, somebody behind a dugout somewhere or behind the screen is there's a manual entry in some of this too. So how good is the data? I don't know, but it's probably going to evolve, and we're probably following some stuff that isn't even predictive. Right. So, in a year or two, we're going to be, we're not even going to talk about this stat because we found out it wasn't predictive. Right.
So cough, max X velocity.
I don't know which ones, but I appreciate the work that you do, and Zola and the rest of the Erickson. And I mean, a lot of great projectors out there, and I take a look at them all. And then I kind of focus more on the lineup kind of stuff and playing time, and see what tidbits I can pick up from spring training or manager, you know, more of the mining the news Zimmerman kind of stuff, right? That's kind of where playing time advantage, right? Because the rate stats are there. You're probably all within a small range on those things. And I think if we can guess the playing time right better, that's an advantage.
Yeah, and there, and that's the beauty of it. There is no really truly correct way. I do know that, at least in my opinion, having a little bit of blend like you do, like I think I do and a lot of good players do, that balance of intuition and experience with the stats, with just kind of, you know, sort of common sense knowledge, because I think people that go to the extreme one way or the other, like, you know, the oh, it's all the eye test, like, oh, he just, you know, just feels right, is a little too extreme. So is the, well, you know, he's his batting, you know, has been unlucky with his BABIP the last couple of years, and so he's due to hit, you know, 37 points higher, or, you know, just the excess statistical approach, I think, is also a little much. There's something missing that, and so I think the blend there is very important. How do you create your own rankings? Like, what are your, how do you sort of tier the positions? How do you sort of create your own sort of personal adaptation to the market and into ADP?
Yeah, just if I go back to 1 second on the bias, I did get burned by D. Gordon for sure, or more than 1 year. So the idea of a speed guy and no power, maybe it's a good bias to have now that I don't go for that, right? So when you give up those other categories, it's hard to make it up. I mean, you already got to average, 22 or 23 home runs per spot, and to plug a two or a three in there, it really makes it hard. So I'm kind of gone away from that. And if I would just follow Lindy's advice from the beginning in terms of these blended guys, I was in a draft earlier with DC with him, and yeah, he's still same thing every time. He's going for those same type of guys. And I veered off of that a few times and paid for it. And I got to stay away from that. But
I'll just pair up my Joey Gallo and Miles Straw. I'm good.
I got
the perfect player, right?
Yeah. Those are fun comparisons to look at when you do that, to do that. But in terms of my rankings, I use RotoLab, to be honest with you. And then I tweak. I like that program a lot. And then, you know, I can move guys up and down, or I could change the stats or the playing time at bat. So, or I just highlight. You can use a number of different colors. You can adapt that thing pretty well. And finally figured out how to do it for cut line. Merv was probably sick of me from asking about questions of how to convert it. And then this year it came over nice. So so you can convert it to cut line points as well. And that's helpful. So I do like the RotoLab. And then of course I have a ADP sheet. And then I really lay out round by round which guys I'm kind of targeting in those rounds so that I don't forget about somebody and, you know, that kind of thing.
Do you have, first of all, I want to say RotoLab also same thing. I use it very much, and it's very helpful. I always would love for Murph to come out earlier, but obviously I know that it's not the easiest thing to come out in early January. So I wing it in some ways, especially in drafts before then, as I'm doing my prep and haven't really solidified a lot of thoughts. But by the way, did you personally, have you added Seiya Suzuki in there, or are you waiting for him to sign? Have you found a way to get him in there?
No, I don't know how to get him in there. You'll have to teach me.
So I did, and I guess someone else, I forgot if it was Genset or Silver, but someone did the same thing. It was basically just changed Ichiro Suzuki, made him unretired, and just used him for now and just put him on.
Okay. I just like when he got drafted, I just skipped that spot, you know, so that the draft still lines up. But yeah, I was gonna, that was on my list to ask. You know, there's a couple players that need to get added, I think, but for the most part, it works.
So do you have any type of, I'm sure you're familiar with the something that's taken, and it's really funny because it started with an article I did a couple years ago now. It was my interview with Casey Cha, and people have really kind of taken to it and made thing it their own. It's really taken off the cross off list.
That was a great interview, by the way. That was a glimpse into his mind, right? That was awesome. Really appreciated that, because he, you know, nobody really knows Casey, right? Like you got pretty close with him and were able to have that interview with him. That was really cool.
So with Casey, first of all, probably we're happy that we haven't seen him pop into any of those draft champions yet. We know he's coming soon. I think he will be there soon, but but with his cross out player style thing that I think a lot of people have adapted, you know, crossing out 50% of the player pool. How are you with that? Or is there a point where are there players that you will not take whatsoever? Are there players that you are okay with past, you know, a couple rounds past ADP?
Right.
How do you?
Yeah, good question. So I think it's a little dangerous just to try to copy somebody else's strategy. I think there's quite a few people falling into that little path there. But I don't, I might have a couple that I won't draft, but I don't, most of the players are all at a certain price would be in play. So I just feel like there's just so many ways to construct a team, and depending on how it flows and what your first picks are, leads into the second pick, leads into the third. And man, there's almost a use for me that I feel like there's a spot for nearly most of the pool. There's mm-hmm. not that many that I cross off. So definitely different from Casey on that.
Does that mean that your teams have more variance? Like when you're looking at your player shares page at the end of your 30, whatever teams you draft because you have people that have 70%, 60% of specific players. How is your portfolio more diverse, I guess?
Yeah, it is more. I definitely cast a wider net, I think, in terms of the player pool. So, I think later on, after round 15 or whatever, then I think I got more of the common players that I like, and that they could, by that time, hopefully you've got a pretty balanced team and they all fit. But up in the early end, probably more variety than some other teams. So I don't know if that's good or bad, but mm-hmm. It could be good, I guess. But
I'm same boat. I mean, I think there may be certain players that I end up not drafting just because I have them, say, ranked lower than their ADP, and there's always somebody kind of going after them. But there are also those I was talking about in my article, one of my articles recently about there are sometimes those helium players that you just know that people like. There's kind of like they're
right.
the more sexy players that that if you're not taking them a little ahead of ADP or at ADP, you're pretty much not going to get them. So you almost have to make a decision, like a conscious decision. Okay, I want to have some shares of him. I'm going to mix him in or not,
Right. And to my detriment, Vlad was one of those for me last year. Didn't take him,
Aguero Jr.?
Yeah. 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 Uh-huh. Yeah, that Vlad, the other Vlad. Yeah, so I won't hesitate to take him this year. I'm sure there'll be a few players that I'll be out on. That I mean, just not because I'm out on them, but they're just going before I would take them. So
that's actually a perfect segue because I just thought of this because it's been, I don't know how much you pay attention on Twitter to all the a little bit of the back and forth and all the fun a lot of the people are having, but the recent discussion this week and it kind of segues into roster construction.
Sure.
Vladimir Guerrero Jr., people talking about him not being an ideal first round pick, or at least middle of the first round, because of how deep first base is later and the fact that he doesn't really provide a lot of steals. I don't know. Have you seen any of that chatter, and how do you feel about that?
Yeah, despite not posting very much on Twitter, I do follow a lot of the discussions because there is some, there can be some good stuff to be gleaned, right? And some of it mm-hmm. is garbage, but we got so many analysts, like experts or whatever, podcasters that are fighting with each other and doing mm-hmm. goofy things. It gets a little annoying, but whatever. In terms of baseball content, I like the baseball content that you guys provide, and that's great. And, I take it Vlad in the middle of the first. I mean, I guess the argument is now you don't have steals, right? Well, if you mm-hmm. take a pitcher, you don't have steals either. So there's definitely he's such a tremendous hitter that I don't think anybody should pass on him. I mean, I could see why he goes in the middle of the first, but I could also see why somebody would take him at the top part of the first, right? So, there's lots of ways to construct a team and win this thing. So, for me, I'm not going to pass at a certain point, right? But
has your how do you feel about starting pitcher in the first round? Were you part of the group that was less comfortable doing it a few years ago and that you're more willing to do it now to get that rock solid ace in the first, or just in general, how do you feel about the early starting pitcher in NFBC?
Yeah, that's a good question, right? The whole industry has moved a little bit more towards the acceptance of first round pitchers, right? That wasn't even a thing when I started, mm-hmm. and not even, maybe even as soon as 6 or 7 years ago, it wasn't really a thing. Now, it's a good way to start. I mean, it's been proven that you can win with it. I guess until last year, nobody had ever won doing the first, mm-hmm. I think.
That's right.
But that was kind of a little bit of an anomaly, I think, because there's lots of good teams that were taking pitchers first. And I'm good with it. I was probably on it, you know, like with most of the people, I would say, not way before the idea. My buddy Doug Gruber, he's on it a little bit quicker than I was. He won't hesitate to take two and then a couple closers. I mean, he's more aggressive on pitching than I've been. I like the well-rounded hitting a little bit more than he does probably, but there's definitely an advantage. You go through a year or two or a contest or two where your pitching is terrible, and boy, you'll change your mind pretty quick for the next year, right? Like, there's nothing worse than trying to uphill battle on your ratios, right? Like, you just can't get there. It's like...
Yeah, but I also feel that if somebody has a bad experience with it, like if you pick the wrong starting pitcher in the first and they get hurt and you didn't have a good year, I think it could incorrectly impact how you feel about building with a starting pitcher the next year. And I did point this out in my starting pitchers article on FTN last week. The top five overall in the main event, including, you know, two teams from Phil, DeSalt and you know, Emmett Rulin, who came in second, Tyler Jung, and then Brian Sackett Brian Slack and Nicholas Sackett.
Yeah, yeah.
All five of those teams drafted a starting pitcher in the first round. And literally none of them, and it was Bieber, it was Bauer, it was Nola in 15th overall, it was DeGrom, and I forgot, it was somebody else, and Giolito. And I think Giolito was the highest ranked, like maybe I think 70th, 90th overall was his kind of end of the year total. So basically all these teams absolutely crushed it with basically a busted first round. I mean, obviously those few months of DeGrom, you can't really call a bust. And, you know, obviously Giolito was fine, but like, you know, they survived. They picked up the Robbie Rays and the Logan Webbs and had the Teoscars and did what they had to do. So it's just, you know, kind of a good... It's interesting how.
So what's your takeaway from that? Like, they didn't really nail that pitcher. So would they have been better? Just think if they had a good hitter in that spot.
It's like the butterfly effect, right? Because then your team starts going into a different direction. Because if you start this way, then it just it ends up a different build, and it just doesn't kind of become the same thing.
That's what makes this game so amazing, right? Like it's just the perfect, it's a great puzzle, and it can go so many different directions. And if we did this, then you do this. But if that guy wouldn't have taken that guy, you know, you could just keep going round and round. It's just amazing.
The best.
So fun. Yeah, best. The best is right. Yeah, it's so fun. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you about things that you do in the season, during the season, because you shared with me a couple of, I guess, screenshots of some of the work that you do in the season, and it made me realize that it's something I always plan to do. You know, again, I mentioned Scott Jensen. I know that's something that he tracks during the course of the season. You know, Rob Silver, all these guys, they're tracking their work during the course of the season. But yours is, it seems really complex. It's a lot of work for a lot of teams, I feel like, and it's very sort of math based, and you know, looking at how your team is flowing and where your weaknesses are. But I guess for whatever you can share, you don't have to essentially open the whole kimono, but no, tell us about that.
It's nothing real. It's no real secret sauce here. So basically I'm a firm believer of tracking. It's a weekly, you got to win every week, or you want to win every week. So I start with goals for each team, right? So in the main event, the nice thing about NFBC, you can look up the historical stats, and I like to shoot for that 80th percentile of each category, right? So you look at last year. If you feel like this coming year, nothing's going to change, the ball hasn't changed, whatever, I just go with 80% of what last year's was as my baseline target. And using the assumption, of course, it's going to be different in the 12-team OC, right? There's going to be more wins, more saves, higher everything because the player pulls a little bit better. So for each of those contests, you come up with a target number for each category, and then you play 26 weeks, so you just break that down into 26 separate weeks, so then you know that you need to get 49 RBIs and 17 homers for the week, or whatever the number is, the goal divided by 26. And if you can accomplish that 80% and make that every week, well, then you're in good shape, and you feel like you're going to have a team that's going to win your league in all likelihood, and also be in contention for an overall, because but it's not easy to hit 80% on all the targets. So it just forces, for me, it just forces me to track it weekly, keep the weekly in mind. You can see pretty quickly. So then on Monday morning, I just enter all the stats for each team. Not that hard to do. NFBC has a couple of nice drop downs where you can do weekly stats. And so then I just plug in the numbers for at bats, hits, runs, you know, across the board. And then just a little conditional format type of thing in Excel. And if it's over the target, it turns green. If it's under, it turns red. And then the next section of the spreadsheet is just cumulative. So take week one plus week two plus week three. And then we know what the targets should be at the 3 week mark. And then if the cumulative is on track, then you get a green. If not, you can kind of see, basically, it gives you just a visual of where you're deficient at. And maybe that affects some fab choices, or maybe, you know, you got some guys hurt and they're not to worry. You know, really, I'm only tracking five steals down and I can make that up, right? So some you worry about. I don't have different degrees of green or red or goofy stuff like that. But for me, it's just I like the green, red, and it gives you an idea of how you're tracking each week and what that cumulative looks like. So that's Monday morning for me. Every Monday morning is entering all those stats. I try to, it takes like, I don't know, an hour to do 30 teams or something. I do Doug's as well. So it goes pretty fast. So once you have the spreadsheet built, you're just plugging in numbers. Maybe there's a way to export it. I haven't figured that out, but I'll have to talk to Derek about that. I don't think there is a way, but yeah, so I do that. And then, so that's Monday morning. Then you got lineups, right? So I spend a fair amount of time on lineups. I love, you know, I use the RotoWire starting pitching chart. I use Razzball for the weekly, the period stats. So then I do the pitcher ranking that you guys do, and Zola puts out a pitching ranking. So I kind of look at them all. I have a roster sheet as well for each team. So that's kind of important too. So that as you think about each team, you can look, I know you can search it very easily on NFBC, but you can also, if you put it in a spreadsheet, I kind of like that. And then I can put my notes on, like if a guy's hurt, I color them red. And it gives me just an idea of what the roster's looking like. And one thing I do on the pitchers is I actually rank the pitchers by what I think they'll be performing for the rest of the year. So like, you know, Cole will be a one. And, you know, I use maybe pitcher's list or one of those other formats of ranking and just do a V lookup and compare it to their list. And then I kind of like that so that I can see how many top 100 pitchers do I have. I want my roster full. You know, as the season goes early on, you want to just keep building that staff to be better and better and better, right? So that those starting pitchers are at the end, maybe you got six top 50 pitchers instead of what you started with four, right? But so it just keeps me focused on just continuing to improve the squad as it goes along. So those are just a few things I do, I guess. So.
And then what about, I guess this sort of blends into the discussion on FAB and how you attack it, but what are you looking to come out of a draft in terms of, are there categories you're more comfortable chasing in FAB early on in the season? Like, do you have certain rules? Like, I need to get, you know, 2.5 closers as it used to be, or I want to have, you know, one good catcher, or anything specific about your roster construction you want to leave the draft in that you know you can you have a better handle on in FAB or early in April?
Yeah, good. I really shoot to do a balance out of the, I don't try to be deficient in any. And the reason we choose that 80% mark, I think, is just because if you go 80 across the board is far better than 70 and 90 in two categories, because once you get over 80, you know, if you put a bell curve on those stats, you can see that you're not getting the same points as you increase over 80, right? So that sweet spot for most categories is right around 80. It may change from year to year a little bit, but it makes no sense to get 100% of a category, because you're probably giving up some assets that you could be deploying somewhere else in terms of a player. But sometimes you can't sit the guy, so you end up, you know, going crazy on a category. But in terms of the draft, I just try to be balanced. And closers, of course, this is going to lead to a closer question, I'm sure, right? So
yeah.
Chasing saves or not chasing saves. Oh, my goodness. That's such a thing this year. It's And then back to the fab thing just for a little bit. I think that's one thing I want to improve on that spreadsheet is just to maybe put league fab totals in there. Like, I don't know. There's always one or two guys that don't bid anything. So just cross that off and then think about percent of how much the league fab is left. And maybe I could tailor my bids a little bit that way. I don't know if you've ever played with anything like that. The 12s are so different on that too. So.
Yeah, I know that there. Yeah, I was on a pod, Ariel Cohen's podcast last season. And I remember it was enlightening the way that he talked about how he broke out the the periods of the season, the week, and his sort of personal allocated budget on a weekly thing. And so, and I think I kind of do it a little different, but I think there is something from that approach I can take away because. Keep myself from chasing or spending ridiculous amounts of money on some of those closers early on. You know, I was on a podcast the other day talking about what the heck was I doing spending, overspending on Rafael Dolis when I had two solid closers and then he failed. It's like, you just want to kind of selfishly collect the stable of closers in case something happens and you have to chase them later. There's all these things, but a big takeaway from you and our conversation now is, and something that I've been thinking about for the last couple of months is how I want to kind of continue this momentum of all of my hard work in the preseason and draft and preparing for this one moment, this, those 3 hours that I'm drafting. I want to be more formulaic of how I'm tracking things over the course of the season as well.
Right.
And so, I obviously keep things in terms of fab, but I do need to include basically some of those weekly tools and things that you're talking about and setting up my own sheets for these teams. And I know a lot of people do that. So
I love this. I love the start of the season, Vlad. Once it starts, I mean, that's like the next phase. And I just love the statistical nature of recording the stats and tracking the stats and doing the fab. And, to me, that's almost as fun as the draft prep and doing the draft. I'm maybe weird that way, but I really do love the season.
We're all weird that way, right along with you, I can promise you.
back to the fab balances, what Ariel was saying or what you were referring there to. I used to just like make sure I had enough for the last 3 or 4 weeks, right? Have amount. But now over the years, we progressed to maybe having different at the quarter mark, at the half mark, at the three quarter mark, because it's hard to do that one exactly weekly because the fab pool is so different from week to week. And there's reasons to have bigger bids and you can't get too stuck on weekly fab. I don't think you could take the 1,000 divided by 26 and say that's your, I don't think that works either. That's too rigid. So something in between is what I'm looking at. So,
and one thing that I noticed last year, at least for me specifically, and just in my leagues around all formats last season was, the hangover from the shortened 2020 season, which is what 37% of a regular season, and how your weekly allocation was obviously a much different amount.
Right.
And I feel like that sort of carried over subconsciously into our 2022 season or 2021, where a lot of us were overspending early and kind of short money towards the end of the season. That's something that happened to me. And it's almost one of those things that I knew, but I was still actively participating in it. And then just before you know it, you're like, man, I really could use this extra money here.
Well, you're the one to blame, Vlad. You're the one telling us what to bid. So, for real, your fab article is great. I really appreciate that. And I think a lot of people use your fab article. And so that sets a nice, for me, if we're talking about what we're doing during the season, when it comes to fab, I don't start fab till Sunday, really. I mean, I know a lot of guys start plugging stuff in, but I don't do it till the last day on Sunday. I usually have a pretty good idea what you need. The watch list function I utilize extensively on that. And really the copy paste bid thing is nice, and the waterfall, and there's a lot of good features on the fab system, and I can roll through that pretty quickly. And if I start too early, I just find myself, I redo it anyway. So I might as well just wait. I wait till I get your article. I look at the RotoWire ones and obviously then you got to fit that to what your team needs. And sometimes that trumps everything and you go for a different set of player. But
I feel like my FabCraft has improved in some ways because I'm writing that article and I'm essentially leaving no stone.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I'm leaving no stone unturned because I'm finding all the players, I'm sorting in all different ways and keeping track of things for each position by 12s and 15s. Of course, because Ian Froh's out there, I'm not winning some of those bids quite as frequently. That's right. The nature of the beast. I'm fine with it, but it helps me prepare a lot better. Like writing that article makes me feel very confident when I'm kind of putting in. So
And I like you bring to light a little bit more of looking forward more than I used to, like in terms of what pitchers they're going to face and handedness, and that maybe comes from your DFS background a little bit more. And I'm not a guy that plays much DFS, so that's all good info for me to look at and think about. And you've helped me with that, thinking that way, so that's good.
Appreciate it. Thank you. So I wanted to just do a little bit more deeper into the players just before we head out here, but just kind of ending things on closers just in general. I wanted to get a feel for your outlook on saves just in general. Like, are you the type that's comfortable grabbing a Hader Hendricks early? I mean, I've seen these guys go in the first round in some cases. We might see at the main events. I mean, who knows at this point? See how the player pool works out, but if maybe somebody at the 15 spot in Vegas will, you know, do the double closers thing at 15-16.
Yep.
I kind of have a feeling I know where you might go with this, because I feel like you and I are similar in terms of the balance. Like me, for example, I can't, you know, how they say, like, sort of paint the board. Like, when I see somebody drafting eight pitchers in a row, and I know good players have do that, or like eight hitters in a row, it makes me personally uncomfortable. Like, I can't do that. I would love to just kind of do a trial draft where just do like, you know, the eight and then eight. For whatever reason, it doesn't work. My painted board is never pretty. It's, you know, all the different colors mixed up. So how do you feel about it?
Yeah, I'm not shy to take closers for sure. I probably draft closers over the history of the main event, you know, fair on the aggressive side, maybe not overly aggressive, but this year is a new level, right? There's no way I'm going to take a closer in the first round. I think they're going, I mean, it's a catch 22, right? There's less saves available based on that we're going to accumulate, because we don't know what the managers are going to use, right? They use a wider array of players to accumulate those saves. So now they're the top ones, if they stay healthy and if they do stay in the role, they're going to accumulate a greater percentage of the total saves that are going to be accumulated by an FBC player. So there's an argument to be made that they should be more valuable this year, I think. Mm-hmm. But I think it's gotten a little crazy. I mean, I'll probably go to the next year. I mean, I love Josh Hader, and I think I was all over him last year for sure, just because I felt like he was going to have that. They were going to commit to him on that closer role, right? Before that, they didn't have they were using him more in the fireman role and in more innings and that kind of thing. But I don't know. What do you think? What's your thoughts on it?
I mean, I assume that they'll probably, you know, let's assume in the next 2 weeks there's some, you know, we know spring training is going to start and season is going to start relatively close to the 31st of March. I feel like we would get clarity in some spots, especially with, you know, free agent signing and some of these guys finally landing places, Kimbrel, Kenley Jansen, Ian Kennedy, whomever else. Then maybe when it comes to main event season, I think there will be enough clarity in certain places where your top 10 guys might be maybe 15 or 16, maybe even up to 18, 20, might get some quotes from, you know, managers that we just sort of know that, you know, that it's going to continue to be a fluid situation where there isn't a set guy. We're going to have to do some more guessing. But my assumption is the fact that these closers are going so high, at least the top guys, at such a premium price, is because these are the draft and hold formats for the most part.
Yeah.
And we've already seen it in the OCs. Like, you know, somebody will always take a Hader Hendricks in the second, but then those other guys are falling later. You can get a Will Smith in the seventh, you know, things like that. So I think it'll change a little bit over the next month.
Yeah, I think that's right. So some normalcy. Yeah, what you're seeing now is it might be more the effect of the DC nature as well as the uncertainty. So hopefully some more viable closers come into the pool and have jobs or stated jobs and brings it all back in line. But hey, there's always opportunity whichever way it goes, right? So I love that part of it, right? So for me, I'm hoping there's people taking Hader and Liam and the turn. That's perfect.
yeah And then specifically on, yeah, just your thoughts on a couple situations, for example.
Oh, sure.
Corey Knebel, are you drafting him at all? Do you think that they signed someone? Do you think they're content with him? Are they worried about injuries with him? Or are they going to add someone big to really kind of mess things up on his, you know, ninth round ADP?
Yeah, I'm taking the approach that it's going to be him. I think he's got the skills to do the job. He's got the history. He can handle the ninth inning. I was actually at the game where he got hurt in Milwaukee. That was an ugly scene. Yeah. But, yeah, I like Knebel, not just because he's a Brewer, but I think, you know, the ninth inning is different than anything else, right? It's not just the skills. It's the head, too, right?
Yep. There's some mentality. Guys
can't do it. So, yeah, I think he's – I like him. I think Matt's got him marked as safe as well. Or he's got a nice closer report going there. But, yeah, I like Knebel.
Mark Melancon on Arizona, obviously it's not a team that's going to provide a lot of saves. Is he, if you had to take a stab now, is he falling off a cliff or is he going to last throughout the season?
He's in between. I'm not taking him. Yeah, that is a tough one. But, you know, I've learned Dave Potts. I've been in several auctions with him, and he just takes those guys. And at the end of the day, he ends up with a bunch of saves, and he spent like $7 on closers. Like, it drives me crazy. But, yeah, I need to learn from him on some of those things. But I think it could be okay. I'm not crazy about him. But
if you had to pick one, if you had to basically I put you on the spot and say, where is Craig Kimbrel being traded to, if at all? And where does Kenley Jansen sign? What would you say?
Oh, I would say Kenley comes back to the Dodgers. Okay. And Kimbrel, I don't know. How about Toronto? I'd like to see Toronto.
That would make the Romano.
Right? They've got some extra assets at catcher, right? There's some talk about some trading pieces there. The floodgates are going to open, I think, in terms of it's going to be a crazy couple of weeks here, right?
Just please, for the love of baseball, get Alejandro Kirk some at bats, please. Let the man hit.
Oh man, that lineup, right? It's good to get some pieces of that lineup, but
100%.
Oh my goodness, one guy I think that's not. I don't know if you're gonna. I think one of the guy that I think is gonna fall off or is not gonna. I have no faith in Chapman for this year. I saw so much last year with his. Maybe he'll be fine. I know he's drafted. Everybody's drafted him like he's fine, but that's a closer that I probably will fade. But
I don't feel comfortable with it either. I feel like I took him in like 1DC and it just didn't feel right. But he's 33. And it's age. I mean, obviously the strikeout rate and everything is there, but that was a guy who has a whip basically around or under one for his whole career, bump up to 1.31. I mean, and a 16% walk rate. It is pretty scary.
Yeah, I don't know. It's his delivery, or he just can't find the plate sometimes. He just gets out of sync and then it becomes mental. And I don't know. He was all out of sorts last year so many times that I can't get that picture out of my head of him struggling and getting pulled a couple times. Like, something's not right with the guy.
And I love Jonathan Lesiege. I think he's incredible. I've been trying to get him in some drafts. And then I think it was in the Discord chat and one of the FTN subs brought up the fact that maybe they would still prefer him as Chapman falters. Right. They might just have Chad Green in that role and have Lesiege. I know both had saves last season, but who is more likely to, you think, grab the job there between those two?
I think Green. I think I'm a little concerned about, didn't the other guy have some shoulder stuff at the end of the year a little bit too? I don't know. Green, amazing year, right? Like, that's so crazy where the wins go to, right? Like, how does Woodruff not get any wins? And
he had almost as many, right? I mean, Woodruff had what?
I think Green had 9.
Yeah.
It's like, it's frustrating, right? It's hard to. Wins another thing, right? You can draft a pitcher in the first round and you're not even sure you're gonna get wins, right?
But and funny, for example, I think anyone drafting like Pablo Lopez, for example, like say he is healthy, they're just I don't know, because he just what he, even last year, 100 innings, 5 wins, you know, the last full season prior, 111 wins, 21 starts, 8, you know, 5 wins.
Right.
The guy never gets over 5. And then it's just baseball, right? Like, and then all of a sudden, you know, he wins 15 of his 30 starts this season. And it's like, oh, but he played for Miami. But yeah, it's crazy. Love baseball.
Yeah. 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 It's just so many aspects of this game that make it superior to football, I think.
100%. Last couple here, I wanted to ask you just random situation. And these are tough. I don't think any of us have clarity. We haven't even seen these guys pitch. We don't even know if maybe they're hurt. But this is just either draft decisions that we're making now. I'm going to throw out three teams with very messy bullpens. If you just kind of had to pick a guy there, or you could just say other, can essentially pass and just say like, oh, I think they're going to sign someone. But starting with San Diego, you've got Pierce Johnson, who's at the top of the roster resource chart, predicting them to close. You have Emilio Pagan, who was basically thwarted for the job by Mark Melancon last season when everybody was drafting him towards the end of March as the guy. And then you got the saves leader from Japan from the JPL the last 2 years, Robert Suarez, coming in on a 1-year contract. So between those three guys or someone else in the pen or maybe someone that isn't on the team, who will have the most saves?
I'm going to go Suarez. I think it's going to be him.
I like it. I'm with you too. I feel like there's something about him. I don't know what it is. It, you know, sometimes you get kind of locked in on a gut feeling and sometimes they hit, sometimes they don't.
Right.
You just kind of sneakily sign, you know, top closer from another league. And
so, you know, he's got it. Yeah. He's got I think so. We'll see.
Okay, all right. I'm with you there. Until they, you know, they trade for Kimbrel and then all bets are off. In Baltimore, you've got Cole Sulcer had an incredible season last year. You know, was kind of sharing the role there for a while with, and it's the name's escaping me. In the first half of the season, he was grabbing a lot of saves there in Baltimore.
Oh yeah, forgot his name. Look it up too. We should know that live.
Yeah. Everyone's listening right now. Like, right. Hey. We're recording late at this point.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to be kicking ourselves. But anyways, Tyler Wells is the young guy kind of came on. Even before the season, it was supposed to be Tanner Scott. And you know, obviously, that didn't work out, and he stunk and then got hurt. But I guess between those three guys or maybe someone else, I mean, there are other, you know, Dylan Tate, other guys there. Who do you think – well, first of all, let me ask you, who do you think starts the season off as a closer if they have one? And then who leads the team in saves?
I think they might start with Sulcer as the guy to start. But I think Wells will end up having the most saves in that. It might not be a lot either, but I like Wells. I think he's a good talent.
Yeah, it's a tough spot. I mean, I think Wells is going just a little couple rounds ahead of him. I think some people are doing the handcuff thing. It was Cesar Valdez.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there you go.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, not an impressive arsenal either, right?
No. Yeah, and a little side question: how do you feel? I wanted to tweet this and ask people that. How do you feel about handcuffing relievers, like, you know, for closers or catchers in DCs? I feel like it's something people don't talk about, but that some people do. And I've been kind of doing it a little bit sometimes inadvertently, in the right spots. But is that something you look at or do at all?
On the catcher thing, I think it's a little different this year with the DH, right? There's so many of these catchers that could really get some at-bats depending on the team construction as DH. So that makes that second catcher more viable maybe. Maybe in Chicago, Yan Gomes is going to get a decent amount, I think, if you drafted Contreras. I don't think it's a bad strategy. I don't know what to do with Toronto, right? Like, Jansen wasn't bad, you know, at the end of the year. But
he can mash, you know, I mean, Mendoza line guy, but he can hit shockingly 25 home runs. I mean, it wouldn't even be a shock.
So those are two, you know, if you can get Kirk and Jansen together, that's not that's good in the DC, right? I think you can get a lot of production out of that.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting thing. It's something that I wanted to dig in more. For me, I feel like it's a draft equity thing. Like, I don't want to take two guys that are, you know, say top 16. It's you know, almost like the fantasy football thing I thought about a couple years ago. It was like, what, it was Mark Ingram and the guy that got hurt on Baltimore, the young guy who's awesome, man, J.K. Dobbins, right? They were going basically the same round on the same team. You're just kind of like eating up your own value. And in baseball, you do have some of those cases. So, yeah, I think I definitely want to be careful. The one thing we don't have to worry about is catcher, for example. You don't have many guys from the same team going around the same time other than Toronto and a couple other spots.
Yeah, I think if you talk about OCs, that's a good – the later picks on some of these bullpens that we're talking about, for example, like the Baltimore one, that's one you could take a couple shots late because you're going to just drop one anyway. So that's not a bad choice. The player pool is so different in 12s in terms of the fab, right? So I think that's where you take some of those shots, or even the cut line too. That's a good time.
Yep.
I usually don't take I don't take closers until the very end. Speculate on a couple, right? Yeah,
there's always someone there for you.
Yeah.
Last one on the on this quick little game that we had. Seattle guys, this is the messiest of all the bullpens. You got Paul Sewell, who was pretty awesome last season. Drew Steckenrider stepped in, grabbed a few saves. They've got Andres Munoz there. They got Diego Castillo, former closer. It was actually had a pretty good season last year as well.
Yeah, he did.
And then the wild card, Kenny Giles, who I was a big fan of, and I would love to see reemerge. But who of this group leads the Seattle team in saves?
That's so hard. We don't have these spring training reports yet, right? Or even practice reports or anything. I'm going to go Giles. I think we'll go on the wild side and go with Ken Giles.
Yeah, we're 3 for 3. We're really? In sync here. Yeah, I'd love to see it.
Yeah,
and this also could be one of those teams that can just be a wild mess, right? I mean, it's there is no set guy, or maybe they go with someone and they struggle. Like, this could be a scenario, and we've done it. I mean, I personally have done it many years where you're almost playing that game of can't catch the closer, right? You're just continuously bidding on guys that are like the new guys for the role. It's a pretty wild game that I don't recommend for people.
Since it's Seattle, they've probably got like 17 trades coming yet before opening day. So who knows what it'll look like.
Yeah. And I mean, that, by the way, I was just kind of staring at that bullpen when I was writing up this question. They're loaded, right? Like if they get something going with the pitching staff, like this could be a pretty interesting team.
For sure. Yeah. Nice addition there, Robbie, right?
My last question, I think you answered it, which was basically which closer among the top 10 was most likely to bust.
Yeah, I jumped you on that one, Chapman.
Yep. Perfect. Yeah, there it is.
I think, I don't know, but that probably guarantees him to have a 35 save season now and be dominant. So I don't know. We'll see. I'm a little worried about him.
That's our game. That's baseball. Like, that's the beauty of it. And it's going to be wild. Like, right. Like, say a week from now, everything is set. These free agents start going. Right. ADP starts bumping all over the place. We're going to want to be in all these drafts. It's going to be great. Like, I'm just, cannot wait for that feeling day they tell us we get baseball back.
Oh, my goodness. The bad part will be if you're in a DC, everybody's going to use the whole clock because they're gasping for the latest news. That'll be frustrating, but I'm pretty much done with my DCs, I think. So close. I don't know.
Yeah, it's time to turn the page to OC season.
Right. Let's go, Vlad. I'm gonna get in a couple of yours this year.
Oh no. No. John, it's an honor. It's a pleasure having you on the show today. I had a really fun time talking to you. It's one of those things where, like, I think we could probably kind of just, shoot the beef here for like a couple more hours talking about all this stuff and diving into strategy. But want to ask you any final words that you wanted to say or just anything about the season?
Yeah, no, I just maybe one thing we didn't touch about is just the great community the fantasy baseball group is, right? Like, we've got all these podcasts, all these analysts, projectors, regular players. It's just such a great community. If you have a chance to go to a live event, that's really, you can see the camaraderie at those things. And I guess I would encourage anybody that's playing is to get a partner or two that you can trust and that you can bounce ideas off. For me, that's Doug Gruber and there's a bunch of other text groups I'm part of. I think you mentioned Scott and Silver on your end. And, I think it's valuable to have a group like that you can run ideas by. It makes it more fun as well, even if you don't share a team, but each have your own team, but to bounce ideas by. And it's just part of the friendships that can develop over the years with this game. So it makes it special.
100%, and it really is such a different world, especially when many people just know sort of the Twitter world and a lot of the personalities. And when you actually meet a lot of these people in person and you get to kind of sit down and draft with people, we're just kind of looking at draft boards and, you know, taking pictures of those draft boards and, you know, talking about strat. It's amazing. It's really a great experience. And so highly recommend it to everybody.
Right on, Vlad.
Thank you, John, very much. I very much look forward to seeing you in March in a few weeks here, hopefully, and when we get to induct you into the Hall of Fame.
Thanks. So appreciate it.
For a very, very special guest and new NFBC Hall of Famer, John Posma, I'm Vlad Sedler. This is the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast with Matthew Davis and Vlad Sedler. Make sure to follow your host on Twitter at @MattyWood_ and @RotoGut. Hit that subscribe button so you don't miss an episode.